drop the baby.
God, right.
First
be
one,
quick.
It's coming in 10 minutes.
Right. Right. Please, God, please, God.
Our daughter-in-law did that.
It happens. My yeah. mother-in-law said she had two babies in the elevator.
Yeah. No, our daughter-in-law, like 10 minutes after she got to the hospital for the first one.
Whoa.
That's really nice.
Unfair.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. That's really very nice.
That is really
That's
nice.
Pure luck.
Yeah.
Yes, it is pure luck.
Okay. Hello. Good morning.
Yeah.
Okay. So, good morning, everybody. Thank you for adjusting. So we're going to do three things today. We're just going to get through cross off and move on. I don't think we're going to get to the next one yet, but that's fine. So we're going to start by finishing about, you know, her relationship with her mother, because it's too breathtaking a depiction not to finish it. And I was going to I wasn't going to do that. And then the second thing that we're going to do is talk about the aunts. You know, and just sort of what role they play. And then a little bit about memory. So if you want to turn to 82.
What's on 82?
82 is when her mom says, "Good heavens, why are you wearing that thing?"
Okay. Oh, she must be in my house.
Isn't that the same dress you were wearing yesterday? Yeah. It makes you look like an orphan.
Yes.
I hang my head, you know, there, all done, you know, she, the damage done.
Very good.
The dress is my favorite, a hand-me-down from Mary Margaret, who is big for her age, as well as 2 years older, but who spends time with me because, as she says, she lives next door. So she gets it from the mother, and Mary Margaret isn't so kind either. Or because, as my mother says, she's limited. So, her, you know, same thing. Okay. I've been wearing the dress all week. Its length and amplitude, in my opinion, cloak me in a penitential holiness as though I were being led to the stake. Now, why is being led to the stake something that, you know, the penitential holiness, the being led to the stake, why is that something good in her eyes?
She's closer to her friend Mary Margaret's religion and acceptance,
okay,
and
so
almost one of them.
Okay, so the martyrdom really fits well with the the story of the crucifixion and so on. And yes, and what else?
This reminds me, I have a grandchild who's 12, a granddaughter who's 12 and a half years old. And I remember her getting some clothes from her friend, and she didn't take it off for weeks.
Yeah.
It's a great comparison to her relationship with the mother.
Yes.
Yeah.
That she,
Well, her favorite thing is not from her mother.
I were being led to the stake.
Right. So, and also because, remember that the thing that she likes to go to church for is to pray for her mother to be relieved of this pain,
right?
And so she's ready to give herself. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, so for her, this is like, okay, I thought I was making myself look like the sacrifice. I seem to remember that you were wearing it yesterday. Do I have to tell you again that's not nice? Go change and be sure your underwear is clean too in case you're run over.
It's right here.
This was a number of years ago, Ilana, you'll remember this, where Ilana's mother said, I have to redo the wallpaper on the guest bathroom. Why? Ilana asks. Well, you know, you never know. There could be a Shiva here and we could need the bathroom. He was like, okay. So, like, in case you run over, make sure clean underwear.
Well, I always remember being told that. Yeah. Or don't have holes in your underwear.
That's right. I always thought so.
That's
right. In case you have an accident and are taken to the hospital.
Or don't wear patent leather shoes. Because you have a refusal.
No, that I never would.
that's from the Catholic school. That's
yes. But the underwear, yeah.
In all fairness, I'm a mother. I think she goes a bit too far.
I would say so. Yeah, I mean... but then here's, remember, she last time we saw how she spoke about the power of euphemism. And this next paragraph is going to be Exhibit A. My mother is generally attentive to detail. My shoes are to be polished, my hair braided so tightly sometimes it hurts, my nails scrubbed, my handkerchief fresh, the clothes in my closet pressed and hung up or folded neatly, my bed made with square corners, but she has spent the last few days in her darkened room with a wet cloth over her eyes, which accounts for the lapse concerning my dress. When she is stricken with a migraine or when the phone rings and she must work at the club extra, either I am to fix my own supper and breakfast or else I am packed off to my aunt's. So my mother is generally attentive to detail, right? That's a euphemism for...
being a helicopter parent?
Worse, no, much worse.
Yeah. Yeah. She's definitely crushed. Not a helicopter parent.
I'm sorry? Crushed by my parent.
Yeah. You know, the hair has to be so neat that it hurts.
Right.
You know, the square corners or else. You know, the
perfectionism.
She's not saying my mother oppresses me, you know. She's just telling us the facts, and the facts are pretty horrendous.
Although I'm not, you know, part of it you have to understand is her perspective on it.
For sure.
Because it's not necessary. I mean... my mom always pulled my hair back really tightly, and she did it because she didn't want to keep redoing my hair all day because it was so fine it would fly, you know, fly out. And I was taught to make a bed with square corners, and that was the right way to do it. But I never felt my mom was oppressive.
Yeah, with her, yeah. So with her, I think it's, you know, maybe that it's in the context of you're wearing that thing, you know.
Well, it's
I mean,
that,
it's
yeah.
It's sort of that larger context in which, you know, her attention to detail means, you know, she doesn't get a break ever. Mm-hmm. Her mother will just not give her a break, and we're going to see that in high school it gets really terrible.
But it's her perception.
Right.
100%.
The mother may not be quite as obsessive as she's making her out to be.
Exactly.
But she sees it this way. Uh-huh. So the mother may be that way also.
Yeah.
But
exactly.
The mother's obsessive about the outside stuff, not the
inside stuff.
Right. Nice.
Exactly.
Right.
It's her way of avoiding any feelings.
Mm-hmm. So I'm packed off to my aunt's. Okay. Best behavior, Lois?
Best behavior, my mother orders? It's no easy thing, no matter what they say, to have a child underfoot, and I want you to make as little trouble for them as possible. No pestering. Do not, under any circumstances, leave a ring on the table. No prying. No personal questions. If your aunts offer you a gift, politely decline it. You have an unbecoming acquisitive streak, and they can't afford to throw money away on foolish extravagances. Moreover, we do not want to be beholden to them. Try not to get the hiccups. They're unattractive and could be interpreted as a bid for attention. Maury has always been well behaved, and the coven will be brewing up reasons to find fault with me. I protest. My aunts always say nice things about her. I tell my mother, hypocrites, she says.
They might say nice things, but they don't mean nice things, right? No pestering, no ring around the tub, no prying, no personal questions. You have an unbecoming acquisitive streak. So sometimes she's very attentive to detail. Sometimes, you know, or from the mouth of the daughter, you know, she'll give us this euphemism. But the mom, you know, an acquisitive streak? I mean, so let's, and then this
you're
creates a little.
Gifts.
Yeah. So go to 89, because this is just so heartbreaking.
I love the use of the word, the coven.
Yeah, the coven, yeah. Right.
Yeah.
89 in the middle. One day my Aunt Bernice and my Aunt Adela bring me. Uh-huh. Everybody see? Yeah. Okay, Lois, do you want to keep going a little bit?
One day my Aunt Bernice and my Aunt Adela bring me along on errands. And there in a shop window we're passing is a fluffy pink sweater that looks like cotton candy, just my size. That will be would be adorable on you with your red hair, Aunt Bernice says, pausing. On me? Joni Hodnicki, the prettiest and meanest girl at school, has a similar sweater, but hers isn't even as good as this one. Would you like to try it on, doll face? My head starts to throb. It's true. I do have an acquisitive streak. Don't you like it, darling? It is impossible to speak or move. My aunts look at each other helplessly. I close my eyes and feel myself sway as I imagine the delirious joy of squashing Joni Hodnicki's face in it. It's all right, darling, Aunt Bernice says. You don't have to come along. I catch them exchanging glances again.
Yeah, okay, so hold on here. Yeah.
Okay, so my mother was reared with four cousins, four who became my aunts, okay. And she would have been fourth out of five in that lineup. And she tells the story, at which my aunts confirmed many letters, that she was told by her mother's best friend in Norfolk before she moved from Norfolk to D.C., never to ask for anything.
That's right. I was told the same thing as a kid.
Never to ask for anything, and she should certainly never ask for new clothes because there'd be three older cousins, and my mother was very petite, and there would always be clothes that fit her. Okay. And years later, my mother and my aunts would talk about how much pain that caused on both sides. That my aunt and uncle would try to buy her something for herself, mm-hmm. and she wouldn't be able to accept it. And she clearly wanted it, and they clearly wanted to give it to her. And it wasn't until she got to the wedding dress that she allowed them to buy her something new, because she was the first to be married and only one to be married. And they talked about this. Never ask for anything.
I was talking.
And she didn't even ask for it. It was offered to her. Right,
right. Right. And the same thing with my mother. I mean, but this was a story of family legend and narrative of how people miscommunicate.
Well, I was just going to say, I don't know. I mean, I was told that. But my father died when I was very young. So we were very poor. My mom had three children. She was very, very poor, and people did try to help us, and she didn't want to take it. And so we were always told, if we went to somebody's house, never ask for anything, never accept anything. I guess I understood it. It never bothered me, really. But even if you were hungry, you weren't supposed to say you were hungry. I mean, you know, if somebody offered you food, that's fine, but you couldn't take something. Or say I was hungry.
But I honestly had the most wonderful aunts on both sides of the family. And that's what saved me, because it certainly wasn't my mother. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
I mean, I had a wonderful mother, but I also had five extras.
My mother was very generous. It's just that it was an appearance issue. She didn't want to.
Right. And so I don't think this message, you know, I don't think most parents today would, you know, kind of give this message to their kids. But I do think it kind of gets communicated to girls not to ask for things, you know? I mean, I think there are some, like, little vestiges of this. But it's heartbreaking, you know? And that's her greatness as a writer. That our heart is breaking because she can't say, I want this, you know? And a lot of people have trouble saying, I want that. And whether it was for good reason or not, you know, her mother said, you know, it comes back. You see, she hears everything her mother says. Mm-hmm. It is my acquisitive streak, you know? And the sweater, and it's just... It's just so, you know, her mother, you know, when she's with her mother, you know, creates the framework that's really oppressive. But even when she's not with her mother has created the framework where she can continue to be deprived, as it were. So
it was an Angora sweater. I'm picturing this Angora sweater.
Yeah. And the delirium of stuffing into Joni's face. You know, so there's a little there. Okay, so go to 91. There are two pianos in the parlor. Julie, do you want to read?
Sure. There are two pianos in the parlor. I don't play the piano. My lack of musical talent is impressive, my mother has informed me, and lessons would only be a waste of money. This is a shame, though, I explained solemnly to my aunts, who listen with raised eyebrows, because my mother says that those of us who will not necessarily be able to rely on our looks need to invest time and effort on cultivating our other assets. My aunts look at one another, and then Aunt China puts her hands over her face and lies back, her lazy, round laugh rolling from her. My mother can be counted on to speak her mind, she says, and Aunt Bernice and Aunt Adela titter a bit sadly.
Okay.
But keep going.
So, yeah, just hold on here. Okay. So what are all of the put-downs that her mother has given her?
You don't have looks.
No talent.
No looks.
Lessons would be a waste of money. And the aunts hear this, and they hear, you know, what she's telling this in a matter-of-fact way, as if this is normal, because for her it is normal. But the aunts who don't think this is normal, they also, what one of the great things about them, I think they understand, is if they were to, you know, to try to cross some boundaries of at all talking about the mother in any way, the mother would stop letting her come. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And they know that there's a relief in, you know, in, so they say things like, your mother always speaks her mind, but they would never, you know, what a cruel, you know, they would never say that. You know, also because it would make her feel bad. Okay, just skip one paragraph and go to, sometimes I think I'll go mad.
Sometimes I think I'll go mad, my mother says about one thing or another, and sometimes I think I'll go mad from boredom, especially in my aunt's empty house with its ceaseless nagging murmur of indecipherable allusions. When I'm so bored, I don't care whether I live or die. I go out and back and consider the ravine.
Okay, so hold on there. That sentence, and we're going to come back to it in a little bit, but that, especially in my aunt's empty house with its ceaseless nagging murmur of indecipherable allusions. Oh my God, what a sentence. Okay, we'll come back to that. That's going to be in our piece on memory. Go to 95. Fran, but it's as if my mother knows.
Okay, wait, I gotta find it.
Okay.
Thank you. Okay. But it's as if my mother knows, because around that time that I enter high school, I always turn out to be wrong. I have gotten a spot on my skirt, or my hair is a mess, or my posture is deplorable, or my mother says, I'm glowering.
Yeah.
Nor do I do enough around the house, and I refuse, in general, to take responsibility. Keep going?
Yes.
Okay. That's true. But when I try to be useful, I wreck things. For instance, my mother has been distressed because the curtains are dingy, and she can't afford new ones. So on Saturday, while she is working, I take them to the laundromat for a surprise, and out of the machine comes a big wad of shredded rags. I throw up, of course. And when my mother gets home and sees them, she turns white, and then red, and then white again. She makes a phone call, puts me in the car, drives me to my aunt's, reaches across to open the car door, waits until I get out, and speeds off without going in to say hello.
All right. So I love the way she says, I always turn out to be wrong. It's an amazing thing, you know, and she doesn't yet attribute it to something wrong with her mother. Mm-hmm. She thinks it's something wrong with her.
But she's also very creative about how she gets back.
So if this would be, but you know that, you know, so you may be saying, like, are you saying, like, there's an aggression, but to destroy the, to destroy the curtains?
No, I don't think.
No.
Oh, no.
I don't think conscience.
I think it was a mistake. I think she was actually really trying. She was, trying to take some initiative.
Yeah, she was.
To be helpful in a way that her mother actually hadn't asked her to be helpful. And I throw up, of course, meaning, you know, when she sees that it turns out wrong, you know,
she's totally. But she must have a lot of experience of it turning out wrong with a mother.
Yeah. Well,
I guess.
Okay, is it really turning out wrong, or is it, it's a spot on the skirt? What else is it?
Her hair is a mess.
Yeah. You know, it's, my posture is deplorable. You know, those are not crimes.
Those are in the eyes of her mother.
Yeah, she can't do anything right.
But
what's interesting is how, okay, her mother can't cope with it, so she's going to go dump it with the ants. Mm-hmm. The ants become the dumping place.
But
I almost think it's better if she had stayed home. Who knows what could have happened?
Yeah, I was wondering about that too.
Like, I know that if I keep my daughter here, something unlikely to go off the rails, really. Mm-hmm. Or
but she also recognizes where the aunt comes and
throw her through the door.
Right.
So
mother must, on some level, be giving her something.
Right. We saw those couple of minutes where where they imitate the men from the where her mother works, you know, and they laugh together, or when her mother allows her to hold her hand, you know. So there are a few things, and you know, I'm minimizing them, but I really shouldn't, actually, because children can live on a little bit. Mm-hmm. It's amazing what kids can survive. It is amazing what kids can survive. You know, I mean, this is like, you know, complete emotional deprivation worse. You know, this is like emotional negligence abuse. Or abuse or whatever it is. But I think that part is important, which is, you know, there is part of her that, you know, still feels connected to her mother. And, you know, whether, I'm sure the destructive parts have her connected to her mother in negative ways, but there seems to be a little bit of a positive way too.
Well, and except when her mother has a migraine, she makes the meals. You know, I mean, she's only on her own when her mother's really incapacitated.
Yes.
Or she has to work extra.
Yes.
And she can't possibly take her for those hours to the cloakroom with her.
Right.
And so she has this escape valve in the aunts.
Yeah.
And the aunts obviously enjoy having her. Mm-hmm. Okay. And have a good assessment of what's going on.
Yeah.
But they're limited in what they can do, or else she won't be there, mm-hmm. and then this poor child will be in more trouble.
Right. And the other thing is, what we've seen is the aunts, because she can't articulate what she wants or what she needs, really, you know, for all sorts of reasons, because her mother's told her not to, or she hasn't learned how to. You know, you have to learn how to articulate needs. It's something that actually, you know, we teach our children. It's something very important. But whether it's because of, you know, she hasn't learned or her mother told her not to, you know, she is in this place where her aunts can't see into her mind, right? So they can only guess so much. And so their success is by definition limited because she can't tell them what's going on. You know, some people are better guessers than others, but not if, you know, if you don't have some information to kind of go on. So Aunt Bernice, tactfully, Harriet?
Aunt Bernice tactfully makes a pot of tea while I sit in the parlor, not crying even when she comes back with the tenderly painted little tray, the tea, the milk, and sugar, and sits down not too far from me. We sip our tea for a few minutes, and then Aunt Bernice says vaguely, "She was a beautiful woman. she might have expected more from life. My brother was a very charming person, but not very forceful. No doubt they both expected something very different. Your mother has had disappointments, and frankly, darling, I suspect that the change is hard for her.
Keep going.
The change, ah yes, it's a fact. I used to look different, a bit like my mother, but now all that's left in me of her are my red hair and my unremarkable legs. Now I look like the other side of the family. I look like the little boy in the photograph, my father. Perhaps she feels it's the end of her life as a woman, my aunt says, gazing forlornly into her teacup.
Right. So by you know, she's notice how she's learned to interpret the worst reflection on her, right? Mm-hmm. But she also doesn't ask, you know, she also doesn't
ask.
She can't ask. Yeah. She can't ask, you know, what is the change? And notice how gentle Aunt Bernice is in talking about, they give the mom the benefit of the doubt. No doubt she expected different things, mm-hmm. and it must be hard for her, and so on. You know, and what's so brilliant about this is you hear what's being said, and then you hear how it's being interpreted, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. The change, oh, she's talking about me, and it's totally not to do with her, you know, and so it's another. So, you know, what happens, you know, her mother teaches her these patterns, and then, you know, she's internalized them, and it's like the mother's gift of insulting her keeps on giving, you know, it just goes back
almost to the very beginning of the story where she calls Jake and she says, my cousin Maury has died. And his first reaction is, did I know him? And that's not what she wanted to hear.
Right. And then she said, he says, do you want me to come by? And she said, I fiercely wanted him to come by, you know, but only if he was going to be a different person. So, you know, but you get from that that there's, you know, her being able to find ways to have her needs met or support and stuff like that are, you know, are out of whack.
I thought that this little section here was very sweet. The aunt was really trying mm-hmm. to explain about her mother
yes.
and that she was this and she was that. And I think that children don't realize that parents have their life. You know, we look at them as mother, mm-hmm. but it takes a while until, it took a while for me to understand what my mother's life was really like. And it explained how she raised us not to have the life she had, mm-hmm. to have a good life.
Right.
And we were very fortunate, but I thought that was
It's so sweet.
She sees that the child is upset.
Yeah, not crying, three times. Why is she not crying?
Because she doesn't want to cry.
She's not supposed to.
She's not, that would be an imposition mm-hmm. on her aunts.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Isn't that, that's so sad.
I love saying the phrase, message sent is not message received.
That's right.
This is so perfect for that.
Right. Okay, and now we get to the top of the top of the top. Their conversation when she makes the mistake of calling, well, not makes the mistake of calling after a few years. So this is 97 at the bottom. I'm just going to read this. 97 at the bottom. There's something we have to talk about. This is not what I want. This is the pretty girls. That's not what I wanted. I want...
That's devastating.
103. Okay, let's read that too, and then we'll get to the highest. This is the penultimate worst.
97.
Ina or Dale or?
Okay, go ahead, Ina. Okay, there's something we have to talk about, my mother says, and closes her eyes for a moment. Pretty girls are not to be envied. Because when a boy sees a pretty girl, he does not see a real person. He sees a mirror of his own desires and he falls in love with the mirror. Boys put a pretty good girl on a pedestal. Do you know what I mean by that, on a pedestal? Obviously, I say, no, a need for
truculence.
A boy will do anything to get the attention and admiration of a pretty girl, and then he courts and pursues her, and when she finally falls in love with him, he understands that she is not a mirror, and he runs as fast as he can. But girls who are not pretty are in an even worse situation. Boys believe that girls who are not pretty have only been put on earth as a poor compensation, what all boys believe the world owes them.
Keep going.
A hazy, swimming rectangle filled like a battlefield with a distant clangor inflates between me and my mother. Though her large staring face floats right in front of my eyes, sweat begins to film my upper lip and under my arms, and I squeeze my clammy hands together as I hear my mother saying, boys know that girls who are not pretty are desperate for attention, and they congratulate themselves on the fact that these girls will do anything at all for what they can pretend to themselves is affection. So when a boy tells a girl who is not pretty that she is pretty or that he cares about her, she can make a fool of herself or not as she chooses, but she believes him at her peril. And I am just about to be dissolved when I feel my aunts with their strange alien faces, which mine has come to resemble, marshal all their strength to cluster in the air behind me and their little family expecting my mother too. And I take a deep breath. What do you mean, I say. That's what I mean, she says. What? That? What I said. She gets up and goes into her room, closing the door loudly behind her.
Yeah. So this is because a boy said hello to her, right? A boy said hello to her when they were sitting in the, the bakery or the, the bakery. Right.
But it's really, she's internalized her whole mother.
That's
the direct connection to the paragraph about we sipped our tea.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely.
Because it's one explanation against the other. Because they tell us later in the story that her husband deserted her when she was 8 months pregnant.
Right. Okay. So, but what is the message, right? You know, you're worse off if you're not pretty, you know, which is you. The daughter knows exactly who her mother is talking about. But what she's saying is, damned if you are, damned if you aren't. Yeah. You know, there's no good way. It's not,
And her aunt's transition from being the coven of witches to being the phalanx facing my mother too. Mm-hmm. Okay?
Isn't that beautiful?
Mm-hmm. It is. I mean... And I take a deep breath, because she realizes that she's not alone.
Yeah.
I mean,
Right.
And it goes back to the tea, and the aunt who comes closer to her.
It's just such an interesting juxtaposition of two realities, I guess.
Yes.
And both of which she's obviously internalized.
Right.
And so then she starts to steal. I find that whole connection really fascinating.
Tell us a little bit more about that.
Well, she's stealing what's hers, in a sense, what she feels is hers, as for a number of things, when you get back to realize her mother doesn't really see the details she says she sees, and it becomes her escape route.
Right.
And so the fix that was there has been in some ways loosened, but as we see clearly from the rest of the story, it hasn't been completely loosened.
Right.
So you get this some understanding of the mother, some understanding of the venom.
Yes.
And why it's directed out of this child who looks like the husband that disappeared.
Right.
And then you get the fix that isn't a fix. Yeah. It's incredible.
Yeah. And the little phalanx facing my mother too, what does that enable her to do?
Ask a question.
Ask a question, not say you're a rot. You know, no. That's all. It actually asks her. You know, she can just say, "I don't. What do you mean? I don't understand this. That's what it allows her to do. That's the big step that, you know, having her aunts. And, you know, it is so beautiful. How many of you are familiar with Harry Potter? Okay, most of you. You know, so when Harry Potter is facing Dementors, which are these horrible, horrible beings, he's able to summon what's called a Patronus, which is, he thinks of something good. He thinks of something beautiful and wonderful and warm and terrific. And out of his wand comes his Patronus, which is this, basically it's the shape of an animal, but it's really his mother and father who are coming to take, you know, to protect him. And I think that's what she does with the aunts, you know. She's able to, you know, summon them at this horrific moment. And yeah, not a small thing that she's not alone. Okay, so right, so she starts to steal. And actually, do you want to read that? Maybe I did want to get caught. You could certainly make an argument for that. Or maybe I did not. But in any event, I did get caught in her room going through a drawer. And by the time I did, and the inevitable annihilating explosion occurred, I was 16, just out of high school, and had grown far removed from Mary Margaret and God and any desire for salvation. And the money I had filched from my mother over the years, hoarded, was enough, supplemented by hitchhiking, to take me nearly 1,000 miles away. Now, what we know is that the psyche is such that you can be 1,000 miles away and still be right next to you, right? You know, we think like if we go geographical distance from somebody that we're getting away from them. No, no, no. And
what's and your relationship with the father?
Yeah, we don't. He left
before she was born.
A couple months after she was born.
Did he leave or did he die?
No, before she leave, or was he killed?
That's what you know. You don't have a relationship with your father. You invent one. But with the only one we're getting is that he deserted his her mother.
Right. Although what Maury tells us later is that he left a couple of months after she was born, and then he went missing. And we don't know if that was of his own volition or whether it was, you know, something having to do with, you know, something else. We just know that he's not there. Okay, so now we'll go to the worst, the very worst. 103. 103. Do you have it, Judy? It starts, really, I believe that I had put my mother.
Yes. Really, I believe that I had put my mother mostly out of my head during those years. But late one night, a little tipsy and with great trepidation, I called my childhood phone. To my shock, the voice that answered was my mother's. And I realized that I had been waiting all that time to assemble a file of unimpeachable credentials before I contacted her. So pathetic. I might as well have been bringing a mauled mouse to my owner's door.
So what is she saying in this paragraph? She's been preparing for this conversation for a long time, but how is she preparing?
The list of everything. All
accomplishments.
Yes, accomplishments.
Right. Unimpeachable credentials. I am going to go with the fact that I'm a college, you know, that I went to school and I have a good job and so on. So she thinks she has girded herself for battle. And then we'll see, you know, she finds out, no.
She can never. Mm-hmm. She knows it at some point also, right here.
Yeah. Okay, keep going.
You might have thought about me, she said. You might have thought about the worry. I was sick with worry about you. I didn't even know if you were alive until Maury told me he had heard from you a year or two ago. It nearly killed me.
Isn't that terrific?
Yeah.
It's not like, how are you? I'm really glad to hear from you. You didn't think about me because it's all about me, right? Okay.
Keep going?
Yeah.
I'm very sorry, I said evenly, though so intense was the flood of vengeful triumph engulfing me that later I couldn't remember how I came to find myself on the floor after I hung up the phone. though a few bruises suggested that I had simply lost consciousness for a moment and clunked myself against a table on the way down. But you did say that you despised me, that I was a worthless waste of your life, that I was personally repulsive, whatever you meant by that. Now, how could I ever have said anything like that you knew the minute I was born that you should have given me to some poor stooge for adoption, that I smelled, that you never wanted to see me again, that you would have treated me for Maury in a bag of compost any day, that sort of thing. I was disappointed in you, she said. I said things I didn't necessarily mean.
You know, so, okay. Uh-huh. I mean, that is really...
Too little, too late.
Yeah, but listen to the things that her mother said. You know, cause
well,
she,
but she still continues to say, that's the thing.
Yeah.
Right, but a worthless waste of your life, you know, personally repulsive, could have been given up for adoption. Like she has a list of particularly cruel things that her mother said to her. Yeah, okay. Yeah, let's keep going.
Do you want me to keep?
Yeah.
Ah, well then, I said. After all, you were no picnic. Are you in trouble? Do you mean am I pregnant? Well, she said. I was not pregnant, I told her, nor was I in trouble of any kind. I had only called to tell her that, on the contrary, I was very well. I did not mention, of course, that I had graduated merely cum laude. But I did let it be understood that I had done well enough at a respected college, not one she respected, as it turned out, and had gone on to acquire a graduate degree, and that I was with a person she could hardly sniff at, someone who did work with deadly pathogens. With, she said, a person? I heard her sit down. Not to worry, as it happened, the person I was with was a man, a very nice, flawlessly presentable man. A man who had stood by me, a man who had a high opinion of my abilities and character, a man who, in fact, actually liked, and this paragon a doctor? I hesitated. A researcher. I see, a researcher. And how long have you been with this researcher? How long have we been living together, I said? A few years. Living together, she said. Is that how I grow up?
Okay, just one more paragraph.
Okay. Most of my intimate involvements had lasted from about midnight to about 2 a.m., as my mother might have expected of someone not on a pedestal. But the span of this particular liaison, with which I had intended to impress her, had obviously had the opposite effect. And after all this time, I was still not equipped to endure her opprobrium. Well, I said cheerfully, marry in haste, repent.
Yes. She started to chortle, but collected herself. Yeah.
But she couldn't, this is somebody who could not have accepted anything positive from a mother. Doesn't matter what she would say. And this kid,
She couldn't have accepted anything positive from her mother?
Not verbally.
No, yeah. The mother would find some way of twisting it, that it's not something she approved of.
But, at some point, this person has become her own person to some extent.
Yeah.
But she can't accept. She can't see her mother any other way than the way she sees her for the most part during her life.
Right, and which is like all of us. Mm-hmm. We all have our own perceptions. So her perception, you know, her perception of what happened.
It's a woman from hell.
Yeah, so we're reading about her continued experience, and after all this time, I was still not equipped to endure her opprobrium.
But it took her a few drinks
to have the courage to call her.
Right, but I thought I had girded myself for battle. Mm-hmm. But my mother knows my weaknesses, and she can get me every time. It doesn't matter that I have a boyfriend of 3 years, a long-term relationship. Doesn't matter that I have a graduate degree, you know, and...
It doesn't even matter that I'm happy with who I am. Yeah.
Yes. None of it matters. None of it matters.
I'm never going to be good enough.
Yes.
But she even knows that herself, because the mother says, and is this paragon a doctor? She hesitates.
Yeah.
A researcher.
So why does she hesitate?
Because she knows that
it's not a doctor.
But it is a doctor. Yeah.
But even if it were a doctor,
it would have been the wrong kind.
Doctor.
Right. So he's a doctor, right, but the wrong kind of doctor. No matter what, it's
not good enough.
Yeah, it's not good enough. And, you know, you would have thought after all of these years, but, you know, it sounds like from, at least from what the daughter describes, the mother has zero self-awareness, zero, zero, zero. You know, that after all these years, she might have said something, but just to like pick up right where they left off, you know, it's so sad.
She still manages to have a very good relationship. Mm-hmm. Not a very, I don't know, 3-4 years isn't much in my book, but
yeah. So after that call, we spoke from time to time. So by reaching out to her mother, even as awful as it was, she does reestablish the relationship. Mm-hmm. So they speak from time to time cautiously, mm-hmm. cautiously. Because at the end of that, well, I said cheerfully, marry in haste, repent at leisure. What she has learned from her mother is a way of sending forth the zingers. You know, it's a kind of quick-witted return fire, and so she's kind of able to do that, you know, but again, she's not prepared. After all this time, I was still not equipped to endure her opprobrium. Mm-hmm. You know, it just she continues, you know, thank God she's much older, you know, she's accomplished and so on, but I'm impressed that she spoke to her from time to time.
Well, I mean, very definitely, neither one of them have been in therapy or an element.
Yeah.
Right, right. That's true, right. Okay, you know, just your worst nightmare of a mother. You know, you could be worse. You could be worse. You could, you know, starve your children. You could, you know, put cigarette burns on them. There are worse parents, you know. But in terms of psychological oppression and abuse, this one's pretty high.
Well, she did emotionally starve her daughter.
Mm-hmm. That's a very good.
No, I agree. I think because there were no cigarette burns, because there were no bruises, she got away with it year in and year out.
Yeah, good point.
And right. So it makes the child even more vulnerable.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because, yeah. I mean, all she has to show for it is wearing the same dress many days in a row.
Right.
And, I mean, she has no way of crying out when there are no physical signs.
Right.
But we were brought up, my generation, none of you are my generation, yeah. But my generation was sticks and stones will break your bones, but words will never hurt you. And you stuck to that to a great extent growing up, because there were strict rules for some of us growing up.
I think that the mother is extreme, but I don't think that much of what she says is out of line of what a lot of mothers
say.
Yeah. I don't think it really is. I mean, she's extreme, and she goes
worthless
way overboard.
Worthless waste of life.
Yeah, that's what I mean. She goes way overboard. But a lot of what she's doing, she's a single mother.
Right.
She has to work at a job that doesn't pay very much.
Right.
She doesn't, you know, she sees herself as not having anything. And she has this daughter to raise.
Right.
And the daughter isn't perfect, because she's never going to be.
Right.
And so, I mean, I can see it. I understand it. And, I mean, I, you know, obviously she's extreme, but the bulk of it, I don't think is, and that's what, to me, what makes the story work, is because it's not so out of line. See, I don't see it as so extreme. I know that when I was growing up, I mean, just to use myself as an example, my father died when I was like 4 and a half. My brother and sister, who are 8 and 9 years older than I am, had a very different childhood than I did. Mm-hmm. And it's very dramatic. And my mother was a wonderful person, but her interactions with me were very different than my brother and sister.
Right. Because it was a different time of her life.
Well, that's the point.
Right.
That's exactly my point.
Yes.
And because she was suddenly stuck with three children and no money and, you know.
Yeah. I mean, I think you can, you know, you can have some empathy for the mother, but I don't think you can excuse.
Oh, I wasn't trying to excuse her.
You know, you can understand it, but there's no excuse for
treatment for what she does. But I think the context is not all that out of line.
But the context can be a lot of this. But
right.
The person loves you.
That's right.
And it's definitely true, Mommy.
Isn't this great? Mother-daughter.
I'm
telling you.
My own parents. My father smacked me very hard. One week I landed in bed for a week. But my father loved me, and my mother didn't.
Mm-hmm. And children know that.
They do.
Okay. I mean, I think she inherently knew her aunts loved her.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And because she had some love from her aunts, the fact that she didn't have it from her mother was in stark relief.
She got it.
Yeah, I mean, she had a broader support network than she would have other. And she was very lucky in that regard.
Yeah. Okay. Go ahead.
My favorite line though is at the funeral.
Oh yeah, we're gonna get to that. Okay, so we've seen the aunts as the protectors. Oh, 107, the letter from Maury.
Oh, okay, I was on 105. All right.
So some years earlier, I had tracked down Maury's address. Sorry, 106. Okay. He was already famous, and I wrote him a letter. He organized it into questions to which he responded with a numbered list. Look what she has learned to do. She has. Mm-hmm. She's asking questions. Mm-hmm. You know, mm-hmm. and she's imposing on somebody to actually write back and answer her. This is important. According to records, our crown ring grandfather, you know, so she goes through, you know, Lot killed in the Holocaust, primary language in any case, Yiddish, which no nationality. Your father, my Uncle Joseph, went missing the month before your birth. Attempts to trace him unsuccessful. Went missing. So
that means.
You don't know what that means, but it was a nice way to say it. If it's the worst, if it's an abandonment, it allows for her not to immediately take it as an abandonment. Attempts to trace him unsuccessful. But here's the important part. Maury went on to say that it was very good to hear from me, that his mother and her sisters always spoke of me with affection and hope. And that he had fond memories of playing cards with me when I was a child and once taking me to a movie about extraterrestrials that seemed to make a big impression on me. So her aunt spoke about her with affection and hope. Why affection and hope? They could have said, you know, with kindness or good memories or whatever. Affection and hope.
Because they knew what was going on.
Right. They hoped that she would get out of it.
And they also, you know, had hoped that the mother would turn out differently as well. But you said something earlier that the aunts didn't know what was going on. I think the aunts really did know
what was going on.
Oh, and they understood the situation. And they provided unconditional positive regard for her. And even they were support for the mother because they became the dumping ground and the mother knew that the daughter would be cared for if she went there.
Yeah. What I meant by they didn't know what was in her mind was they couldn't know that she really wanted that sweater.
Yeah. I think they did know.
Oh, I think they did know.
Oh, you think they did?
Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
Yes,
but they also knew what it would do if they bought it.
Right. That's the whole point I was making.
Yeah.
That this charade went on for years and years and years.
Yeah.
Yeah, they knew the boundaries.
And it wasn't until it was a wedding dress that they could break the charade. Both sides knew.
Yeah.
And the taboos were so intense.
Mm. Yeah, no, they knew
could
exactly.
Not break. That was
so they
taboo.
Knew. Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So that's really interesting. Okay, thank you.
I mean, to me, the thing about the mother that really clarifies what kind of person she is was the thing at the funeral, where, you know, what that this one's a mumbler too, what's he saying? Mm-hmm. That she was an exemplary person whom we all loved and looked up to very much. My God, they're burying the wrong
That was a good line. That really was a good line.
That says more about who this woman is.
Okay, so let's go to the funeral, because that has some, in addition to that line, some other stuff. 107 in the middle. After the funeral service, Ruth?
After the funeral service, there was a little reception at my aunt's house. My mother was sitting alone at one of the little marble top tables, sipping something. She was staring straight ahead, her face devoid of expression, as if she were dreaming the house and everyone in it, the subdued bubble around her, hubbub around her, her life. It struck me that I myself would be old before too long. I hesitated but remained standing, and then went over to say a few words to Aunt Charna and Uncle Benny. I expected something immense, Jake said, gazing around the parlor. It's not really all that big. Was it possible that he was actually a bit dim? I was smaller back then, with fastidious patience. It looked miniaturized to me, too, of course, and only seconds from shuddering into splinters. But it had almost finished serving its purpose anyhow. In the following few years, Charna died, and then Adela, and then my mother. And now that Maury is not around to remember them, my aunts may be finally released from the house. The elegiac murmuring of the carpets and chairs and billiards table and clocks, the unquiet sleep hovering over it, bringing dreams of the planet my grandparents came from, with its blood-stained ghetto walls, the pistol butts beating at the doors, its rhapsodic festivals of murder. Will I finally miss them, my aunts? I sit up on the couch, a bit drunkenly, to take note. Yes, off they go, my old allies, sailing right through the harsh, radiant shield at the edge of the universe, blending into darkness.
So beautiful. What is happening? What's the nature of her experience in these last two paragraphs, or this last paragraph? It almost finished serving its purpose anyhow. Mm-hmm. Cross it off, moving on, right? Mm-hmm. In the following years, they died, right? And Maury's not around to remember them. My aunts may finally be released from the house. What does that mean?
Well, that was their life. Oh, they were tied to that house and those memories and that place.
Right. And when she thought of her aunts, that was the house. The house was.
She didn't see the house the same way the aunts did.
No.
Of course not.
The murmuring of carpets and chairs, the unquiet sleep hovering over it, bringing dreams of the planet my grandparents came from. Uh-huh. So, you know, she. So in the house, and we heard about it a little earlier, we didn't read it though, where, you know, she sees, it was a great description of, you know how when there's a ray of light and you can see the dust, mm-hmm. because right, of the ray of light, yeah. You know, and we hear that the mother says they could at least dust, you know. she talks about that. But this is definitely the realm of memory, is the house. You know, the aunts are in the house. The house is, you know, this experience of her childhood.
You know, also, I'm sure you all have a picture of this somewhere, of your relatives going back with one person with the gouted foot sitting there. And, you know, it's the relative picture. So here we have... Hear no evil, see no evil, speak no evil, but we see them almost as a reincarnation with vestiges of the old world.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, and the samovar.
Stories go with that, those memories. I mean, it all is one package.
Right, right. So it's about her her memory of all of this. Do you all, when you think of your aunts and so mm-hmm. on, do you think of them in a particular place, like in a house?
Mm-hmm.
I do. Yeah, I definitely absolutely. Do. Yeah. You know, when I think of, I forget what the street was, but you know, it's a particular house with a particular backyard.
Hobbit Street.
Hobbit Street. That's my grandfather, right? No, I was thinking
where the aunts live.
No, Barbara. Oh, that's another one. Yeah. You think of a particular sofa in the living room, and that is the nature. You know, because our memories are of people and things, and you know, the picture in our minds is where we're with them. You know,
it's our point of reference.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. You know, I had. My mother's sisters were very close. We all lived together. My father's sisters were sort of spread out. And there was one sister, her name was Becky. My mother didn't like her. But that was from the other side. But she was very kind to me. Now, I had a younger sister, I have to preface this. And when I went to stay over at my Aunt Becky's house, she gave me a whole package of Wrigley gum, a whole package, because I always had to break the gum and share it with my sister, one piece at a time. But one time I did say to her, she was kiss me, and I said, you know what, you kiss just like Trigger.
The horse?
The horse, because it was a big wet kiss. you have memories. Right. I remember the street, I remember the house, mm-hmm. and a whole package of gum.
Mm-hmm. Right. So, I mean, I think. One last thing about memory, and then we'll just say a concluding words because we run out of time. 87. This is the gauze, the samovar. A samovar, my mother says, for God's sake, I don't know why they don't sell that ruin of a house and all the vulgar old trash inside it and get themselves reasonable little places of their own where they could live independently away from the spell of that harpy and at least dust. The dust in my aunt's house is the dust of transformations, a languid floating gauze that becomes sparklingly apparent when the rare light comes in through the tall windows. The gilded armchairs in the parlor are upholstered in dark velvet, so worn on the seat and arms that the white muslin shows beneath, a ghost poised to emerge from within a dying body. The immense oriental rugs are worn almost white in places too, but as you study them, the sleeping intricacies begin to surface in the weave. So her aunt's house is the dust of transformations. You know, she has all of these memories connected with that house, learning about her, you know, her aunt's parents and some of the family and so on, Maury a little bit. And, you know, memory can function in various ways. You know, memory can imprison us, you know, if we don't somehow work it through. But memory can also be liberating. That's what, you know, Pesach is all about, right? The power of memory to liberate. And so, you know, her mother was the jailer, and her aunts were the, you know, to whatever extent they could be, they were the ones who, you know, who were her shield.
Safe haven.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. And, you know, and so we don't, you know, at the end, we know that there, why is there hope at the end? I should do that before we finish. Jake asks her, what would the love letter have said from her father? And what she understands, he took my hand with such sweetness, I think I blushed actually. Looking back, I suppose the future, its chilly plan for us, had cast a fleeting shadow over him, and he was searching for what I would need him to say to me when the time came. Even though she's going to break up with him, this is not going to last. But she knows that he was, you know, consciously or unconsciously, that she has needs, and he was even going to try to meet them even when he was breaking up with her. But back then in that fragrant garden, I was aware only of the light coursing between our clasped hands and the sun's warmth on my face, with the night idling where it was half a world away. So eventually, the father left, eventually Jake would leave. But he was searching for what I would need him to say to me. That gives me hope, you know, that she could articulate a need, something that was a need.
Her needs might get met.
Yeah, that her needs mm-hmm. might get met, that she might be able to ask the question of, you know, what do I want in life? And, you know, the questions that help you to make your own person and to overcome whatever experience you have to overcome rather than...
But it's a positive in the end, which is good. Mm-hmm. And this is a purse. I think she had... enough support from the aunts that she could fulfill herself professionally.
Well, she
and
did
also have a relationship.
Yeah, it was enough so that it got her to be able to go to graduate school and to be able to, you know,
to function,
to be in a long-term relationship. It didn't work out, but you do have hope that she's been in one long-term relationship. Maybe she will be able to be in another.
Well, the minute he defended her mother, man, she shot him.
Yeah, that was that. That was that. Can't do that. Yeah. So, but I think, you know, and it's also about language. Language has the power to destroy, and it has the power to build up. What happens here is the human spirit can prevail over a lot, you know? It just, mm-hmm. you know, she endures and succeeds to whatever degree she can because, you know, we have these reserves of strength, you know, wherever they come from. And, you know, she was able to overcome a lot.
Wait, just one second.
The other thing I thought is that we all live with ghosts.
Yes, right. Yeah.
It was very interesting. You know, Racheli Frankel spoke at our synagogue on Shabbos and yesterday. Her son was one of the three murdered boys. And she is, like, so unbelievably inspiring and spiritual.
Yes.
But the rabbi, when he gives his, you know, Dvar Torah on Friday, he remembers asking Racheli, how do you smile after the tragedy that fell upon you? Her courageous answer moved me deeply. I feel pain, she said, but I don't have to become my pain.
Yeah.
And that's why I smile. So when someone had, you know, you have to figure out what to do with that pain.
Yes.
It's a very different pain than this, but...
Yes. But I don't become my
forward,
pain.
You don't become
right.
my pain.
Right. Mm-hmm. Thank you. Yeah.
She was, oh, my God.
Okay.
Heavy duty. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Good story. Happy Thanksgiving, everybody.
Thank you.